We are doing a discussion, a panel on the ACTA copyright treaty, which is most notable for the fact that no one knows what it says. And
which is making it somewhat challenging to come up with intelligent remarks about it.
So I'm Chris Hoffines. I am an Atlanta area attorney at the firm of Casey Gilson. Sorry. Better? I'll project a little bit too, if that helps. My name is Chris Hoffines. I'm an attorney at Casey Gilson here in Atlanta. I do a lot of franchising and IP work and also some railroad defense, which is actually a lot of fun.
I'm Courtney Perry. I'm a local attorney as well. I used to do the big firm thing. I'm now primarily an academic. I teach at Emory at the law school there.
Yeah, I'm a trial attorney. That was important.
Yeah, my legal background is corporate law rather than litigation, so you kind of got both sides of the fence here. I still do some licensing work and copyright work. That's my main income source of legal work. But so we're both IP lawyers. He's from the litigation side. I'm from the corporate side.
And the ACTA treaty is a secret. We don't know what it says.
So we're going to talk about it for an hour. Yeah, we're going to tell you all the things we don't know.
Okay, that was great. Really, the problem is that no one knows what it says because it's being negotiated in secret. It also appears to have stalled since President Obama is having some difficulty with filling positions in his administration. He's actually really way behind. So there's nobody to negotiate for the U.S. So that's all that. The only other kind of information out there are some documents that have been leaked. Specifically, if you go to the Wikipedia article on the ACTA treaty, they have a link to the WikiLeaks article or document. And what they have is a discussion paper with just some points. There's no draft, there's no text of the actual treaty out there. So.
And that discussion paper has been somewhat disclaimed by the EU, who reacted to the leak by saying that's not a draft of the agreement, that they are, since they're still negotiating the, I'm sorry, that vibrates back, I've started to speak loudly. Since they're still negotiating the actual treaty, they're not releasing the text of what they're negotiating from, but it's not at all uncommon in a treaty negotiation to not yet have a document from which they negotiate. It seems counterintuitive, but especially when you're doing a multilateral agreement where you have so many different parties with different interests coming in. If it's sponsored by one nation, they may come in with a working document, everyone negotiates from that. And when you have a true multilateral negotiation like this one is or is becoming, you often don't start with a document. You start with, let's agree on some points, and getting diplomats to agree on some points, even if it's something like this, can take a really bloody long time. So when they say that there's not actually a document or a treaty, it's probably true. What they do have, that I think by now I believe they are admitting they do have a working document.
I think so.
It's some of the timetable stuff is a little bit hazy when you kind of go back and read through the releases, but for a while they were saying there was no document, and that most likely was true. Now I believe they're admitting to a working paper that they're working from, but they're keeping it secret, which is frustrating to people who want to comment on it. But again, on one level, we're so accustomed to open information that it's somewhat frustrating not to be able to see everything that we want to see when we want to see it. When you're dealing with multinational negotiations, it's not at all uncommon to want to keep things quiet so the parties have some chance at least to talk amongst themselves without having to deal with, you know, in effect, heckling from outside, and without having to worry as much about the political pressures that will come after they come to an agreement. Not necessarily what people who want to bring those political pressures to bear on the negotiating parties like to hear, but from the negotiating party's standpoint, it makes a lot of sense and allows them to progress much more promptly through the subject matter, as slow as that is. But anyway, that was going on. The discussion paper is the closest thing to a document that's out there. It's the one that's been leaked, but the EU took an official stance saying, yeah, that's not an official paper. That may or may not have been one of the things that was circulated for people to comment upon. But it's not the text of the agreement by any stretch.
And the discussion paper is not necessarily technically accurate as far as what the treaty or a legal document would be.
Yeah.
There's a difference between two people saying, I'm loaning you $50, okay, I owe you $50, and lawyers drawing up a contract which will take 10 pages.
To say the same thing.
Yeah, because you have to cover all the bases and have to be extremely precise. So what's in the discussion paper, if you see it, is the I owe you $50 view on things, not the very particular, very precise legal view. Do y'all hear drumming?
Is this like vibration thing only in my head, or is this everywhere in the room?
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, it's like, it sounds like that one has some static going on. I'm not sure.
It's like, are those voices only in my head? Do y'all hear them too?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, good. Well then.
So, do you want to just go right to questions, or do you want to try and talk down this paper?
The one thing that I think if you look at the act of commentary on the internet, a lot of it is very shrill and hysterical. Not all of it, but some of it is really overreacting, and it's funny to me because we don't know what's in it. And that in itself is somewhat troubling. We're a society that likes open information, and the Freedom of Information Act that EFF, amongst others, filed was squelched, so that's going nowhere anymore. The Obama administration said, no, I'm sorry, national security, not going to see it. That in itself was a little bit confusing, but...
So the objection was literally on the grounds of national security for a copyright treaty?
That's my understanding of why the Freedom of Information Act was denied.
That's odd.
Why would that have any bearing on copyright treaty?
We had a question from RBAC, which was, why would that have any bearing on copyright treaty?
Economic security. Anyone in national government will view economic security as equivalent to military security for the purposes of invoking and denying a FOIA request, saying this affects too many billions of dollars, and right now, until we're prepared to release the information, you won't hear anything.
And the other thing I noticed looking down the discussion paper was that there's some stuff that looks like it's pointed at competitors, especially China. Mm-hmm. So that may also be the source of national security.
When they talk about national security, sometimes it can mean not pissing off our allies. It doesn't have to mean we're just fighting terrorists. It encompasses a wide variety of things. And although whenever people hear national security, they're, again, often the knee jerk is to assume that it's, you know, covering something up. It's not that big a deal, and again, it's commonly used so that they can get through the negotiations without having to handle dispute from within the country. Again, not necessarily a goal that everyone agrees with, but what the government wants to be able to do. And I don't know, obviously, I don't know what's in ACTA. It is possible they have some of the, they may start having provisions, and they're not just about trademark stuff, which also somehow counts to national security. It's certain that they will have things about about counterfeit goods. ACTA is not just going to be about copyright infringement. It's not just about Pirate Bay. So it will also cover counterfeit goods, we assume.
Yeah.
And counterfeit goods can be, I mean, we've read in the past couple of years of, you know, toys from China with lead in the paint, and, you know, toothpaste actually with lead in it from China. So if you start having counterfeit goods coming in from countries with poor quality control, it's a matter of national health at least, which can be covered in the same rubric. So it seems strange when I first saw it too, that national security be invoked to keep a copyright treaty quiet, but it's not as unreasonable as it seems at first blush.
ACTA actually stands for Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, so counterfeiting's in the title.
What are the issues that the treaty is trying to address? It announced their specific goal of what they were trying to do with the treaty?
It's what they said is that they're trying to basically create an international standard for IP enforcement.
And the EU had something official about it, didn't
they?
Yeah.
And then also just to deal with copyright and IP enforcement.
The European Union folks actually announced the threefold goals of ACTA, which was international cooperation, enforcement practices, and a legal framework for the enforcement, all relating to intellectual property rights. And it's so it's broad. The goal is to have international cooperation. We've talked in a couple panels here already this year about, you know, well, if I put my server in, hypothetically Sweden, or if you start going multilateral or multinational with where you're hiding bits of your pirating empire, it's very difficult for the
any of the governments to enforce their local or even any of the treaty rights. So one thing that ACTA is, we believe, attempting to do is establish a multilateral framework whereby the rights of the individuals within those countries can be enforced. How it's going to be done exactly, they ain't telling us. But it's not in that level terribly shocking.
Can you give me an overview? Can you give me an overview of what's existing for dealing with international issues? Like, what is ACTA trying to replace, if anything?
There are a variety of international agreements that overlap, and God, there's a dozen or two. The World Intellectual Property Organization has a number of treaties. The Berne Convention is the large copyright act. There are a number of small, like bilateral agreements between countries about piracy and stuff. Every now and again, China signs something with us. Every now and again, Japan signs something with us. Japan actually now has content, so they're starting to want to protect it, but they have their own weird rules. China, of course, is a big source of pirated goods, and they're very good from time to time about signing little agreements with us, promising, oh, we promise we'll never do that. And they file it with the rest of and move on with their life. So there's a variety of international agreements, some of which are of some use and some are not. The WIPO Treaty and TRIPS and gosh, what else? The Berne Convention is the copyright one. There's starting to be some trademark ones, which I'm not as familiar with yet.
I think the best we can say, because it's so complex, is that under the Berne Convention, other signatory countries must honor the copyrights of other signatory countries. But there's no real enforcement mechanism or Interpol-like organization so they can quickly take an infringement in the United States and start enforcing it in Sweden.
And it's one of the big shortfalls that a lot of the rights holders have been noticing is that, you know, it used to be, okay, we were concerned mainly with the U.S. market, that's where the most money is, then we'd be worried about our market in Europe. Well, with, you know, again, I hate coming back to the cliche of, ooh, but the internet changed it all. Well, the internet changed it all. And so now it's not enough to be able to enforce your rights in the real countries that have real enforcement, because even the other countries are able to get your book and post it to the internet when you didn't want it to be. And those sorts of things need a multilateral agreement in place to have an enforcement arm, not just, as the Berne Convention, most of the, God, it's 160-odd nations now, isn't it? Pretty much every nation, with a few exceptions, are signatories to the Berne Convention, which is the copyright, international copyright agreement. We were fairly late to the table. We were one of the last of the real countries to get there. But the Berne Convention basically says that if you are if you live in a country that signed the Berne Convention, your work will be protected according to the local laws wherever you are. Otherwise, if it was a foreign work, yeah, good luck with that. You get no protection whatsoever in a foreign country. Under the Berne Convention, all countries agree to treat members of the signatory nations, citizens of the signatory nations, as if they were their own citizens for purposes of copyright law, which is great. That means that your book will be protected in England the same way it would if you were an English citizen. It does not, however, really help you if you want to shut down the pirates. So the this act was one that's been pushed for quite some time by a number of different groups wanting some agreement between the nations to help enforce the laws.
Well, just shout it.
We can hear you.
Whoa.
All right, do you want me to replace it? Here. I'll fix this.
I have a question back on the secrecy again.
Okay.
They actually also mentioned something related to the U.S. state signed the Berne Convention. I had an initial knee-jerk reaction of secrecy was, you know, done for nefarious reasons, because I'm used to thinking of it. At what point is a proper time to panic? Because I would
very loud.
That works.
I would assume that at some point, if everyone says, yes, it's done, and then the next day every country says, yes, we agree, we will implement this in our individual legislation, that we will have lost an actual window of opportunity in which panicking is appropriate and complaints are appropriate. So I'm curious what the timeline normally is for these type of treaty negotiations, when things generally become open for comments, and when we actually can complain and do something to change, anything that is nefarious within the bills or within the treaty.
Well, you can always complain.
But
the internet's there. You can complain now.
Well, I think moving forward at the timeline for the treaty itself would be at some point they'll have a draft. It will go, you can bounce back and forth and be edited some by the various negotiating parties, and then it'll be signed. Once it's signed in the United States, then it has to go to the Senate to be ratified. And without that ratification, it's a dead letter.
It can go the way of the League of Nations if the Senate doesn't ratify it.
Right.
Oh, no, I meant, is there a time period between when they publish something that people are as a working copy versus when
for international things, if there is, I couldn't even begin to guess what it would be. I think that since each one is going to vary so greatly based on the politics within those groups, anytime you get the different parties in a round table like that, you've got a whole lot of politicking going on, and it just depends sometimes on how long it takes them to quit posturing and start talking. Once they have a real good working draft that actually is close to approval, then I would think someone would release it. Not leak it, but actually release it. I've been surprised that nothing has been leaked aside from this one thing, which, since there have been so many different groups going in and actually speaking on this and having an input on this, there are a lot of NGOs and a lot of different, even corporate groups going in and talking to this. The fact that nothing else has been leaked is what makes me believe that there really has not been a draft. Because if any of these guys had gone in and had a draft in their hands, someone would have leaked it. And it hasn't been done. So either they're like a death penalty for leaking this document, or there really has not been one yet to leak. But that's a very long way to go around saying an answer that I hate to say, which is I have no idea. But at some point there will be a draft that's a somewhat final draft. Around then I would expect it to be not leaked but released. And once it's signed, by definition, then you'll be able to see it. It would be a public document. And nothing goes through the Senate quickly, even today with Democrat control. It's still going to at least get some discussion before it's ratified. But when it comes to the Senate, it would be a great time to pitch a fit if you feel an obligation to do so.
My question was, wouldn't it be perhaps easier to instead of have companies do regional releases via like the region coding and DVDs, et cetera, with DVDs to just start releasing things globally? Obviously, people want stuff on other continents now, and that's something that has fundamentally changed ever since the internet came up. Instead of writing a whole complex treaty over something that's basically maintaining a status quo.
It may be that that when this treaty is signed, assuming it is signed, that it will allow them to do exactly that. One of the reasons, at least as I understand it, that the different regional releases are made is to at least in some way minimize the widespread effect of piracy of each release. If there were some cooperative enforcement mechanism between the different nations, it may be that that becomes obsolete. In terms of would it be easier, it's done for economic reasons, not for legal reasons. That's their practical way to try to avoid some of the piracy. And there's no legal requirement that I know of that they continue to do so.
And the treaty point, what we have on the treaty does not have, as far as I can see, a discussion of the actual technical details of how the DVDs are encoded or anything like that. So
That's a manufacturing issue that would not be covered by this treaty if it were to say anything I expect it to say.
Okay.
I can't say it's not in there because I haven't seen a text of it, but that's not the sort of thing that this kind of treaty would normally address, but it may be a secondary effect that if there becomes a more global or at least multilateral approach to enforcement of intellectual property rights, then those things may just become obsolete. And once they're obsolete, it's an expense that the companies can drop and they won't do it anymore.
Yeah, encoding for region has nothing to do with any type of treaty or law. It's a matter of the reaction of the industry to try to prevent piracy. So
if they can at least limit the piracy by geographic area, that's what they're doing. They're trying to partition it off.
So with the new treaty, if dropping the zones, or whatever you call them,
the regions,
if dropping that actually makes more economic sense and make more money, certainly they'll do it.
That's market, not legal, really.
Okay.
Is it possible that they're actually trying to develop the framework for enforcement as, along with the laws, and that could be why they don't want to make public the details of the treaty, because that would give a chance for the pirates to beat the technologies before they come up with them?
Probably not. Yeah. The technology is the treaty is at more of a strategic level, and the technology that the pirates would be interested in would be more of a tactical level. So they're really, it's an apples oranges comparison.
Yeah, the treaty probably will not have any specific technologies referenced. I mean, there'll be references to technology, but it won't be a, here's how we're going to encode our CDs going forward. It won't be that sort of detail, because these guys won't know that. A lot of the folks sitting at the table are not technological experts. They never are. So they'll be passing laws that are, at least one would hope, general enough to adapt to changing technology, not be specific to one.
I just wanted to toss out one more thing on like the region coding related things, as somebody who's worked with the cable and movie industry. All of that stuff is derived by their ancient business models, which are so specific. The region coding, even though, yes, it is about piracy, it's not even about piracy in the counterfeit way that we think about it. It's about cannibalizing markets that are controlled by distributors who own a region. Okay, so MGM will sell the rights to reproduce this movie on DVD to Singapore United Limited, who has agreements to sell to China and to Japan and to Singapore and to Malaysia. Now, they might sell American titles dubbed or whatever, for whatever reason, at their equivalent of like $35 a DVD. If you could buy an American DVD that would play on their players over there for 15 bucks, then all of a sudden that distribution partner is cut out of his income stream. And damn it, he has exclusive rights. And to tell you how minor or how extensive this nitpicking is, for instance, in video on demand, the studio releases a movie and the lawyers get to it, and just like in a doctor's coding office, you go to HBO or Stars or any of these types of places, there is a file explicitly stating for every single title, and inside they have guards walk around with the master tapes when they check them in and out and to code them for things.
Wow.
To say, this is what you're allowed to do, and it's so granular that when Stars is told, for instance, that they can release whatever the movie of the week is this week, they can show it on their cable channel ad infinitum for whatever the license period is. They can distribute it so you can watch it on your video on demand service, but they're not allowed to show it in hotels. So if Stars is carried in a hotel and Stars knows that, they cannot.
They have to block it.
Yeah, they cannot send that VOD package to them, because whoever the provider is to the major hotels has the right, bought the right for that picture to show it in hotels. And I mean, and they're on this. And it is to the point where the reports and stuff that are kept, I mean, are legal instruments for getting people into trouble. So yeah, it's a big deal. It's all about distribution. It's who can copyright,
yeah,
as we all know, is a two-edged sword. One, it's about keeping it locked up, but it's about the people, whoever are to get the money, having the right to release control for that copy being made. So, and the one other thing I wanted to get into real quick, if you don't mind.
No, that's cool. That was news to me, so.
Yeah.
To what they were saying on the legalese, we're dealing with like three or four layers of abstraction here. Okay, one, you're talking about a movie industry and stuff that, one, of course, it's profitable for lawyers and the entertainment industry people types. That's a business model for them. You know, just like an accountant wouldn't tell you you don't need accounting services even if you're only managing 50 bucks, because, well, that's what he does, right? So, you have that entrenchment, and you have the people who are used to working that way. At the government level, when you talk about this enforcement, they want to say that we recognize that copying something that was protected by copyright or trademark or anything else is bad. And therefore, when bad things happen, law enforcement powers in whatever your country are related to do that. They are never going to get in, because they are just figuring out that DVDs exist relative to a government function level, no less the fact that there is encryption on DVDs of different types or region codes. If they worked on legislation like that, especially with countries around the world having to agree to it, I mean, they can't even get Blu-ray and cable labs out the door and stuff like that. And some of those things, proof positive, I've seen the reports, can save the affected industries at stake billions of dollars in the amount of reprocessing, re-encoding, all types of things that they're doing, and they can't get it done because there's just too many layers in the puzzle. So yeah, the technical stuff, the people who want to circumvent things, they'll pretty much always, locks are for honest people, they'll pretty much always be a way to circumvent it. The question is now, is everywhere in the world it going to be a $700,000 fine for a $1.99 song on iTunes if they catch it with it? That's the kind of thing we should really be worried about.
Yeah.
So obviously, I guess we don't know much about what's being negotiated, but what
it's,
are
it's kind of challenging to answer the question. Yeah. It's like, well, I don't know.
Well, so I guess I would like to get a little better sense of what the context was. Somebody asked what the current treaties were, which seems to be a kind of complicated mess of things.
There's
but,
a billion of
but
them.
But presumably, there was some publicly stated context as the partners went into the negotiation, and there must also be public positions that have been taken by some of these NGOs that are at the table in individual countries and are, I presume, talking to the State Department in these countries or something. I mean, I have no idea.
Trade representative.
I don't know how these things happen, but
it's being negotiated through the Office of the Trade Representative.
Okay, so and the NGOs go talk to the trade representative, and a trade representative seeks out the major industry groups and things like that.
We still lack one, don't we?
So I'd be interested in knowing what the state of play is in terms of who are the major, what are the major kind of positions that are being argued here? What are the alternatives that might come out of this?
Well, let's see, the general government position is breaking the law is bad, and to the extent that piracy is endemic, that they want to more effectively prevent law breaking. I would say that the recording and movie industry's position is something along the lines of, oh, piracy is everywhere, we have to stop it. And
get the pirates.
And that they are seeing pirates under every bush.
Not
under every jellyfish. And then people like the EFF and other organizations with a similar mindset are, in a lot of respects, more concerned with bringing copyright law in line with the transformational effect of the internet and the fact that we no longer are in the same paradigm. The copyright law really is about books, and it's kind of been wiggled a little bit to deal with movies and records and tapes. And as long as you can analogize back to a physical hardbound thing of pages, we're going to stay on the same model. That has to fundamentally not work anymore, and be obvious about it before the copyright law is going to change. Just because if it works and all the people who are having to fiddle with it on the legal basis, all the lawyers and the companies and the judges, then they're just going to stay with the paradigm that is developed. Only when it's just simply not feasible to stay with it will it change.
And we're not far from that on some levels. Copyright protection really is a bad match for software at all. It just inherently doesn't work well. Copyright, the way it is intended and the way it was formed originally, expressly excludes anything really functional. If there's a purpose or a product, it's not going to be copyright. It's either going to be patent or it's not protectable. So copyright's meant to go for the form, not the function. Unfortunately, someone convinced Congress that software is a written work, and there is an expression of an idea, and copyright's all about expressions of ideas. But software isn't about the expression of the idea. Software is much more akin to a machine. It's a process. Something happens through your software, whether it's a game, whether it's accounting processes, whether it controls the HVAC system in this building. That's not the same as a painting. And it's so fundamentally different, both in the fact that it's abstract rather than, and here's the book. It's also functionally very different, because if I'm talking about a book that's protected by copyright, what I say in the book, if I come up with new facts and new theories, those are not protected by copyright. If I am the one who decides that, God, what was the Nash v. Bridges one? That was, of the outlaws is still alive? Jesse James or something was still alive, and one of the guys was, and dude was not shot by the woman in red outside the theater. Which gangster was that, Dillinger?
Dillinger.
There's a book about Dillinger not actually being shot. He survived. And it was a great conspiracy theory book with nothing aside from someone thought he saw them in a city 5 years later kind of thing. And this guy wrote this great book about it, which was then pilfed to the ideas out of that book were taken and used in a Simon and Simon episode. on TV. Author sued, and the court said, well, you know, your crackbane theory was put out as fact. And since these were facts you came up with and said were true, you have no control over them. They're ridiculous and stupid. However, you put them forth as facts. Therefore, there's no protecting them. Copyright does not protect facts. It does not protect ideas. The original case on that's Baker v. Selden, where there was an accounting process. I forget if it was Baker or Selden, both of whom were dead by that point. But they had, they're the ones who, one of those guys, was the first one that came up with dual entry accounting. And wrote a book about it, explaining exactly how to do this great new accounting system, which worked very well and people still use it, and gave charts so that you could run your business using this new accounting system. Well, that book did not sell well, but one guy who bought it said, this is brilliant, and wrote his own book saying exactly the same thing with copied, not just expressing the same ideas, but dead copied charts. And got away with it because what he stole was not the expression, but the underlying fact or process. So copyright's not meant to protect anything useful. It's only intended to protect the pretty stuff, or how I say it. If I write a poem, I own my expression of, wow, what a pretty sunset. I don't get to keep other people from saying, wow, what a pretty sunset. That's intuitive. We know that. I can't own sunset poetry just because I wrote one. Obviously, I'm not a poet, or I would have come up with something much more intelligent to use as my example rather than what a pretty sunset.
Jellyfish.
Jellyfish was very good. What a pretty jellyfish. If I wrote that poem, I would still not own all poems about jellyfish. I couldn't keep someone else from doing that. Now, in patents, if I'm the one who figures out how to smoosh the jellyfish and make it into a sandwich, I can keep other people from smooshing jellyfishes and making them into sandwiches. But I can't do that in copyright. Copyright's about expression. When you get software brought into copyright, it just doesn't quite fit because copyright, like I said, it doesn't apply to the accounting process in the Baker v. Selden book.
Actually, a better example might be that architectural plans are not copyrightable because they're just instructions on how to build the building.
But the blueprints can be. That one's a weird one.
Yeah,
That one makes my skin crawl. I get into the details of it.
Okay.
But you can go into
it. I was going to stop there because I thought the instruction aspect.
That's a good parallel to software, though.
But the instruction part of it is not protectable. Perhaps the best one is recipes. Recipes are not protectable under the copyright. If you make a cookbook, your selection of different recipes and how you present them and how you put them together and the order in which you put them, that's protectable. The selection and ordering and editing process is protectable. The add two eggs, stir them, and it becomes a cake method of it is not protectable by copyright. So you can take someone's recipe and it's not copyrighted. So software is much more like a recipe than it is a novel. And a recipe is not protected. No machines, processes, anything like that is not protectable under copyright, yet software is. All of which was starting off of the comment here that when it's completely broken, someone will have to fix it. But for now, I mean, since the 76 Act, shortly after the 76 Act, when they added the express addition of software to copyrightable subject matter, which was 78, when did they? The 78 is when it went into effect. I forget, it's shortly after the 76 Act went into effect that they expressly added software. And it was a really, really stupid idea then. It was driven in part by concerns that patent did not give sufficient protection to software code. But again, this is late 70s. Software code was a very different animal than it is now. They carried software code in boxes because it was punch cards. So it's not what we think of as code, and they were able to show the legislators those boxes of cards and go through the, oh, it's all ones and zeros. Look, I can draw ones and zeros. Look, there's an expression. And they were able to convince the legislators that it was a really good idea. And it was done really by the software industry. So y'all did it to yourselves. To convince them that some protection was necessary because patent was deemed too unwieldy, and for a while there was a period where it was believed that software was not patentable. It actually is under certain circumstances. Some software is, some isn't, but that's true of everything for patents. So it's been a weird history of how we got to this point, but when you're dealing with now the electronic piracy levels, you're trying to use a hammer to screw something into the wall. It's kind of cute, doesn't work as well as it should. And when it becomes completely broken, they'll have to come up with something else, and ACTA may well be one of the we've got to stop a lot of these activities that are going on that are harming either people who are getting lead in their toothpaste or people who thought that they'd written a book that they got to profit from and it's already out and being sold to other people under someone else's name. These things we need to stop, and we don't really have a way to do it. And my understanding is that's in large part what ACT is intended to do. I've got, in fact, a quote here from the one of the few official releases. This is from the European Commission on Trade that says just a fact sheet from last year. So it's somewhat dated, but it's one of the few. This doesn't seem to just be made up crap on the internet sources that I was able to find, where it says, the goal of the ACTA negotiations is to provide an international framework that improves the enforcement of intellectual property right laws. It does not purport to create new intellectual property rights, but to create improved international standards as to how to act against large-scale infringements of intellectual property rights. The goal is pursued through three primary components of ACTA: international cooperation, enforcement practices, and legal framework for enforcement of intellectual property rights. So that's what they're saying about it, and it sounds very much like we've got nothing that does this, so we need to band together and figure out a way. Or so we think, because we can't read the document.
So my question is not necessarily about the content, but about the process. I was just wondering, is it sort of a public knowledge of who is being consulted to sort of generate this? This treaty, is it like just governments, or is it, you know, all stakeholders, just, you know, governments there, and is there any sort of, like, of course you can't have direct public consultation, but I mean, you know, are NGOs being consulted, maybe other citizen groups or anything like that?
There are about eight countries, actual sovereign nations that are in, so they're one set of parties, is, you know, US, Japan, Morocco.
Yeah, it's Australia, Canada, the EU, Japan, Korea, Mexico, Morocco, New Zealand, Singapore, Switzerland, and the United States.
And EU really is a bunch of...
Yeah, EU right, is yeah. Europe, yeah, the European
right,
Union. Yeah, yeah.
But the EU is negotiating as one unit right
but there,
now.
Yeah, now, one thing that list of countries has garnered some criticism on is that the developing nations are not included, but they don't often have stable governments, and I mean, I don't think they'd say, "Oh, their interests aren't being represented." But the reality, if you're not being politically correct, is that most of the emerging nations are where the piracy is occurring, and their interests are directly counter to the interests of these groups. So they have not invited the pro-piracy countries to the table until they have a unified product.
Yeah. And inviting Sudan to the round table on human rights is probably not a good idea.
Yeah, you're not going to get as much done.
Well, I mean, there's a reason that when Iran was chair of the Human Rights Commission, people sat there and went, you know.
And just kind of said, this is silly, let's go get lunch, because there was just no point.
But one of my concerns is that the actual, like, corporate sort of views being represented in any sort of formal way, or is it only through?
They have invited some NGOs and some corporate interests in to speak to them. I have not found a list of who they were. I would assume it's rights holders, not EFF groups.
Yeah, okay. So
I would assume that what they have brought in would be one-sided, but I don't know, because again,
so no, like, user groups or anything, not necessarily pro-pirate, but like sort of, you know, just user.
I would be surprised if there had been any, because for the most part, those groups are all screaming and yelling that they've been excluded.
Yeah.
And I have not heard the motion picture industry worrying about being excluded, so I'm assuming they are not.
Okay, so there's no you know, official list of delegates or anything like
they
that?
They have not released one that I've been able to find.
Okay, so it's just sort of, except for the country list, there's not much there.
It's entirely possible that they assume that people are going to kick and scream regardless of what they did.
Yeah, well, because I'm from Canada, and there's a, you know, consistent sort of public outcry every time any sort of more stringent copyright legislation comes forward.
Right, and they're trying to get some of the negotiation done before everyone fusses about it. They're not quite succeeding, because look, here we are fussing about it. But
you know, just to some extent, if the United States trade representative has to take a public position to satisfy constituents, then it's got to then do that, come back off of it, and then start negotiating again. Yeah. That just slows the whole thing way down.
They have to all come to an agreement before they can go sell it to the home countries.
I mean, well, democracy is a pretty slow process.
It's slow and it's messy.
Yeah.
It's, you know, more than once been likened to making sausage. Yeah, the result may be good, but God don't watch how it happens.
Okay.
Delicious. Anyway,
green shirt.
Off topic, I don't know. Could this have a negative umbrella effect on GNU type product? Stuff that is in the public domain, could it cause a negative impact to that?
probably not. And the reason I'm saying that is because what we have on this agreement talks only about enforcement of copyright. It doesn't actually alter what is copyrightable. So if that kind of bait and switch happened, there would be a lot of screaming.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
And the other thing that kept coming to mind when I was reading this was about the Kyoto Treaty, about global warming. We went in, we were one of the prime negotiators, the United States was, the United States signed the damn thing, and then the Senate, 99-0, told the president, we are not ratifying it. And so if it becomes politically suicide to sign on to this thing, then the Senate's gonna blow with the wind. They're not gonna take a stand.
Yeah, I think of the League of Nations rather than the Kyoto Accords, but it's the same thing. If the trade representative comes back with something that the Senate won't swallow, it's dead. It can't, laws cannot be forced on us by one government representative. But which does not address the original question, which I lost somewhere.
Oh, GNU.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I mean, it's not going to be able to change our substantive copyright law on that level. And since at least what we know about it, and again, I keep wanting to hedge by saying I haven't read it, there isn't one, we don't know, but assuming it is what the EU is saying that it is, it's addressing piracy. And if I've given my rights to you to use my stuff, you can use it. Now, there's been some criticism I've read by some of the, not the GNU folks in particular, but some of the free software groups, the advocacy groups, saying that this is going to have a chilling effect on our ability to use software. You're not going to say that. There have a bunch of folks been saying the same thing, but I haven't found any justification for that concern. It doesn't mean that there won't be something in there, but it is difficult to imagine how it could criminalize something that's not criminal behavior. What it's intended to do is increase cooperation among the nations and have a framework for enforcement, but not to take things out of the public domain. There's no way to do that in our law.
I think one thing that a lot of people fear, including myself, is that somehow, some way, somebody is going to say, well, this applies to our intellectual property, therefore, we're umbrella underneath what they're trying to label as a copyright. In fact, a lot of stuff from the GNU or under the GNU, I band it all together as free license stuff,
right,
is used by companies producing and selling product. And there have been instances, grapevine things that I've heard, that they've tried to put copyright against things built on free models. And that is something that I fear personally, that we end up with legislation that limits people producing free things and then ended up subsequently copyrighting.
A couple things come to mind from that. One is that it's difficult to write a law that cannot be, in certain instances, misapplied or applied incorrectly. And by difficult, I mean completely impossible. We have a very good justice system. You still get really stupid results from it sometimes. O.J. Simpson is still looking for the real killers. No system is perfect. And so you get miscarriages of justice, and you'll get cases where there was no reason in the world why X's company or X's product should have been shut down because it's built on legitimately used free software, yet some country thought it was infringing or was just misusing the law and managed to cause a disproportionately bad impact against a particular company. It shouldn't happen that way, and I can't say that it doesn't. And certainly there's no reason to think that this treaty, should it become law in the United States, would not at some point be misused by some party in another country. I haven't seen anything that's talked about with legitimacy attached to this, which, again, she hedges one more time. No one has read it, but any of the more official commentary on it hasn't sounded at all like there's anything in it that would make that more prevalent than it is now.
I think the other issue is that you own your own copyrights. You can do with them what you want. Charlie Strauss is very famous for releasing his copyrighted works under Creative Commons. He could do it the other way, but he doesn't. I have a great amount of difficulty coming up with a law that would, and then one that was enforceable or an enforcement mechanism to make you
not give away your stuff.
Not give away what you want to give away. You have to tie this thing around your neck like an albatross is practically and legally just so wacko that it's hard to wrap my mind around the possibility.
And that in itself, actually, this occurs to me, is not something that you might perhaps use as something to take to the bank. But you've got two lawyers up here who are much more akin to the folks sitting at the negotiation table than actual software tech folks are. we can't imagine how that could be drafted or done in the framework of an agreement like this. And the folks who are drafting this think like we do. I mean, they've changed us when they trained us to become lawyers. And the way that we think, it's like, that doesn't make sense. We just couldn't figure out how to do that. And the guys who are drafting this think the same way we do. So it's just not the sort of thing that would come out of this sort of process, because it wouldn't make any sense to us and our brethren.
Okay, just want to jump in here real quick. In the interest of full disclosure, part of what I used to do in a former life was I was president of SUSE North America, and had some 600 programmers working for me full-time on GPL, Apache license, and several other projects. And so have a whole lot of experience in this. Most of the things around, and again, you know, just like everything else, can't speak for everybody, blah, blah, blah. Most of the initial knee-jerk objections out of the free software community really come around to, is somewhere, somehow in this provision, since we're talking about counterfeiting and such, are we going to come up with language that encumbrances reverse engineering, much as sections of DMCA does? What is going to affect my ability to reverse engineer a protocol or a device or anything else in order to make compatible software? Okay, so that's, again, in a whole big ball of wax, as large as these things are, that's really, and as a business guy too, I want to say is the most legitimate direct objection that people have, is how are we going to define mm-hmm. what circumvents copyright, so that, you know, if I'm trying to write the next samba, I'm in trouble from word one because, well, the packet still looks like a samba packet on the wire, and that's enough. Okay. And the other one is, when we're talking about law and other things, people from my end of the community go absolutely insane when you say the word public domain. Absolutely, explicitly, nothing that is GPL'd is in the public domain. It has a copyright. By definition, if it has a copyright, the rights are restricted in some form or fashion, which is then in the README file that's there as to what you're allowed to do, what we know as the GPL, but it is not public domain. It's either been given over to the FSF to maintain or the original authors of the product.
That's a really good point. Yeah. I'm cutting you off, and I apologize for it. Lawyers always deal with what we call terms of art, which are precise words that have precise meanings, and they don't, you know, the English language is very notorious for the vocabulary drifts over time. Terms of art do not drift. That is the point of a term of art. And so in a document like this, they talk about it using terms of art, but then people who are normal, not lawyers, look at it and go, and read it as if it's not a term of art. They read it after that drift has occurred.
Yeah, they read it in the real English. We don't. It wasn't written in real English, and we don't read it in real English. So the translation. But again, the fact, I mean, any of those things that your concerns were directed towards could end up in here, probably as an unintended consequence, honestly, as a lot of the DMCA had impact that a lot of people hate, but it wasn't drafted for that purpose. And this is one where, honestly, the folks who will end up drafting this don't understand the technology very well. They didn't understand DMCA. They didn't understand what the hell they were talking about when they added software into the copyright. I mean, keep in mind, they added software to the Copyright Act before anyone had computers. There were like three in the country. There, this big room full of cray was the computers in the world at that point. And yet Congress said, okay, we'll add software. They didn't know what software was. Computers were things on Star Trek.
Well, also, when this treaty finally comes through, and assuming it's a good deal and it gets ratified, there will be a lot of litigation over it, probably. And the boundaries of what it really means will be explored and will get firmed up by various cases. And I assume the EFF is going to be a big player in that.
They'll be right in there with it, I'm sure.
The interesting other thing about this could well be that everybody else and everybody who signed the treaty thinks Provision X means something. And then Congress, in the Ratification Act, says Provision X actually means this over here, which could be totally different. It's like a signing statement that we've all heard about. Congress can do that when they ratify. And so it's also possible that the treaty will say, you know, Creative Commons, you have to enforce it as if it's legitimate copyright, as if it is a
full
copyright. Thank you. And Congress may say, well, we mean that, we think that actually means, no, you don't.
Yeah.
Exactly the opposite. And it's a messy process. So
we did that in a few places in the Berne Convention. We had to change the law to comply with the requirements of it. We changed the law and then said, of course, by changing it, we don't mean anything.
And people will complain from other countries, and we will nod and smile and go about our business.
Thank them for their interest and go back and do exactly what we wanted to do in the first place. So to a certain extent, I mean, we can't say that none of that will occur under the Act. Nothing in the stated intentions or the what it appears it's going to address would do that, which doesn't mean it won't unintentionally or that it won't come in later in the process. But I'm afraid at that point I go back to no one's read it yet. We don't know. Ask us next year when the copy's probably going to be out, and we can address it much more specifically.
And to the NYU guy, because I went to NYU, so.
No, I'm sorry.
Oh, Ethan's, you're next, I guess, then.
Well, he's wearing a company hat.
So I guess I'm curious, you know, where ACTA is in the kind of sphere of things that are likely to change, you know, in the next decade, changing the landscape of copyright for, say, those of us living in the United States. Is ACTA the big thing that's going to happen, or is there, you know, other things on the horizon, which I guess is maybe taking us off topic a little, but I guess I'm sort of wondering, should I go out and read a lot about ACTA, or are there really other things I should pay attention to?
I think that right now it's a tempest in a teapot. There's not a whole lot to it, and it sounds like it really is just an attempt to kind of get a handle on piracy, and that as soon as the model truly breaks and everybody realizes it, we're going to have a whole new model for copyright, or at least a heavily modified one. And at that point, that next treaty is going to be the big one. This thing is just the last, is just trying to kind of keep it together.
This is, it seems at least that this is duct tape. They're trying to come up with some way to keep the current model functioning. I mean, honestly, at this stage, since they've gone on so long, now again, we're guessing. There's this closed room over here, and I'm going to guess a lot of things about it, what's going on in there based on what I haven't heard. So we haven't seen a draft yet. The countries have not come out and said much at all in specific about it. The people who have been complaining and screaming the loudest about it are the ones who know nothing about it. So no one who's seen it is saying anything. And they've had enough third-party groups come in that usually by the time you have two third-party groups, one of them is pissed off. So it's, no one has said anything about it, which makes people concerned, but it's like kind of being afraid of the dark because you're afraid of what you don't know is there. There are a lot of really awful things that could be in this treaty, but there's no actual evidence of them in there, and the official statements are to the contrary. It's not unlikely in my mind that since it's taken this long for them to get anywhere, because they're supposed to be much farther along than they are now. Even though we don't know what they're doing, we know they're a year behind. If it's taken this long for them to get to wherever it is they are, which is behind wherever it was they were supposed to be, it wouldn't be a huge surprise if this wallowed around for a bit longer, kept some people gainfully employed talking to each other, and then petered out into nothing.
I think also the fact that we haven't had any leaks of what's in there means that none of the parties are really that far off of each other's positions. They're quibbling about details.
Or they're so completely off that they haven't come to any agreement.
Right. I think if they were completely off, there would be some strategic leaks to try and adjust the other side. So total speculation.
But we're guessing.
Yeah. Okay.
That dark room, some things are happening. Yeah.
Okay. I think we promised the NYU guy.
Yeah.
You were discussing earlier how the English language drifts over time.
Yes.
But we have to remember that the treaty will probably be ratified in at least two languages and distributed in many more. So we're going to have half dozens of languages, depending on how many signatories there are, so that's going to make even more confusion over the definition of the different terms.
Usually, treaties like this that I've read have one or more official languages.
Usually English and French.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If it's a UN document, then they have four more. I don't remember what the other four are.
And usually, when there is a disagreement between the terms, you try and harmonize them. If you can't, then the English court, the U.S. court, the Australian court says English version, the French court, the Moroccan court, the Swiss court say
French version.
And there's exactly. and it's not a whole big difference most of the time, so it really has no practical effect.
They do a good job of harmonizing them as a general rule.
Well, one of the joys I get to do is enforce DMCA takedown orders. And one of the interesting things is DMCA did change the law in that it outlawed reverse engineering and decrypting mm-hmm. the code, even though it's really lame, you can do it with a felt tip pen. But they said that that's illegal. That was a change. But one of the things that they did that was actually a good thing for us is we, under the current copyright, since we're not really an ISP, even though we kind of act like one, we can't come under common carrier, so we can actually be held liable for what the students might do on our network.
Mm-hmm. And you work for Georgia Tech,
right? Yeah, Georgia Tech. Okay. So, and we were always very sensitive that we have to be very careful. If we start filtering the traffic, then we say we're responsible. But if we don't filter the traffic, and they go after the students, they might hold us responsible. So they put us in a quandary. Well, what DMCA did is it changed the enforcement mechanism. Mm-hmm. So we have what's called a registered agent for the campus. They're the official contact for DMCA takedown. When a request comes into them, we have to respond back with the name of the person who's the actual offender. And if we, within a certain period of time, I think it's 72 hours or a couple of weeks or something like that.
The process is fairly well delineated and tends to work well.
Yeah.
In legal terms, we refer to it as a safe harbor. It means mm-hmm. that if the ISPs or, you know, groups like Georgia Tech that's, you know, like an ISP, is functioning as an ISP in effect, as long as you comply with these rules, you won't be held liable for anything that goes on, because they're acknowledging exactly what you said. Well, you can't really filter everything on there. It's just practically not possible. Plus, you don't want to be in trouble if you miss something. So here are the rules. Let everything go through that you want to go through. If someone objects and jumps through the correct hoops and objects correctly under the takedown provisions, do what they say according to these rules. And as long as everybody follows the rules, everybody knows what's going to happen. And groups like Georgia Tech is not going to be on the hook every time a student pirates something.
And the rules are very, it's a matter of how the mechanism and the agreed-on mechanism of how we enforce it.
Yeah.
So as a result, I'm no longer have to say, well, I can't give you the student name unless you give me a subpoena. Well, now I say, oh, here you go.
You know, from my academic side, that's one of the things that is arguably more important than having a good law is having a predictable law. And the DMCA on that front does a great job. The ISPs and the schools and everyone else who's serving as an ISP knows what they have to do.
And speaking as a litigator, if I'm looking at somebody who's, I have a client, my client's been wronged by, let's say I represent a recording industry company and I have a student. I'm looking at the student going, student has no money, it's not worth suing them. Who may have done something wrong in that student's orbit that I would have money? Hey, university, backed by the state, not bad.
Georgia Tech, deep pockets.
It is worth it. The risk reward makes it worth it. To go ahead and sue the university, see if it sticks. If the university is screwed up somewhere, maybe it will. I get lots of money. It's good. So one of the nice things about safe harbors, and there's a safe harbor provision apparently in this treaty, is it does allow a university or an ISP or another deep pocket to be able to actually function without having to look over their shoulder at plaintiff's lawyers all the time, worrying.
Rules like that also, when the government's looking to create that sort of certainty, things like the a couple years ago when it was in big news when a couple of the telephone companies were asked for records from the government when it was not far after 9/11, and they really were legitimately trying to get the terrorists, the ones who just blew up the buildings. And the phone companies, some of them said, oh yeah, sure, here you go, get the bad guys, and some said, yeah, we're not sure we want to give you our records. And again, there's like, well, what are they supposed to do in that case? And I don't know that Bell South is the correct vehicle to make public policy on that level. So it's arguably a better idea to have had the sort of open process that American laws go through, and that the treaty will be discussed as well if it touches on those kinds of corporate record handovers, or something that has been bandied around as part of it, ISP records and who some of the anonymous users and stuff were. When you have the ISPs, are they going to give over their usernames? Are they not? And that's an issue that everyone says, I want to remain anonymous, and that's great until a school is blown up. And then they think, well, you should give them those names. But making the ISPs make the policy decision on the fly is usually not the right answer. Some of the phone companies said turned over their records in the wake of the terrorist attacks. Some didn't. All of them got sued for having made the wrong decision. So if there are rules in place that had the chance for public criticism and scrutiny, so we know that we watch the rulemaking procedure, we know what the rules are supposed to be, and then if people think the rules are the wrong ones, they have the opportunity to get them changed, as opposed to trusting one company in the midst of, oh my God, we're being sued, or oh my God, buildings are burning, to make the right call on that.
There's a fairly short clock on things like subpoenas. I think it's about 10 days. And when you work in getting it up the chain of command, out to legal, back from legal, that eats up time too. So making an important decision that has policy implications fast, you're just asking for trouble. So we try not to let that happen.
And having a credible rule structure helps keep that from, helps making the bad decisions not have to be made.
We have less, we have negative 2 minutes. Any other questions? Okay, well, hopefully we'll be back here next year. Oh, fire away.
It's like you were mentioning that they're not going to do something insane.
No, I said, we said if they don't do something insane.
Yeah. I think I used wacky somewhere in there too, but yeah, go ahead.
Like how insane is it to completely mandate a complete lack of personal responsibility? Isn't that insane?
Can you give us some context?
How about auto insurance?
I don't think that's in the scope of the panel.
You're not permitted to have personal responsibility in that situation unless you're like a multimillionaire. Think about it. Think real hard about it. Aside from increased rates afterwards.
Any other comments or questions?
Yeah.
Play in the back.
Copyright law and international treaties are obviously very important, especially to people in here. But what, in your opinion, should, is there stuff on the horizon that's even more dangerous to us that we should be aware of?
Tons of stuff, but it's not intellectual property.
Asteroids from space.
No, I mean on a legal standpoint. So for example, I'm personally terrified of patents because you do not know what's out there. You effectively can be sued for infringement for just practicing well-published art of developing software. And I have been told not to even look, because if you know about a patent, then you definitely shouldn't do it because of the triple damages thing.
I'm not a patent lawyer, so I'm going to start with that disclaimer.
Okay.
But oh my God, the patent system is more broken than you can possibly imagine. Any of the things that, I mean, I teach some intellectual property as a general principle, so I'm familiar with the patent process. I am not a patent lawyer. Mm-hmm. But, oh my God, nothing that's supposed to happen is coming predictably out of the patent office the way it should. Things that I was taught were expressly excluded from patent protection are being patented. Things that were expressly included are being excluded. It's broken. There's something in the water in the patent office, and they're drinking it like Kool-Aid.
Also not a patent lawyer, but I think it's fair to say that most things you think are wrong with the copyright system are more wrong with the patent system. Yeah. It's
completely broken. The rules, like I said, not being a patent lawyer, I don't know the technical ins and outs of it, and God help me, I don't understand science for squat. But the traditional joke is that I became lawyers, that lawyers in general become lawyers because we suck at science and or math, otherwise we'd be doctors. Mm. It's a joke because it's true.
So when someone from this room, for example, would be out to lunch with a member of Congress or a senator or talking with these people in various things, what could be mentioned to bring up the thought that when this sort of thing comes up, that it's not some academic industry giant like Microsoft. Oh yeah, I know so-and-so, he's in my district or whatever, and he's said that these affect him.
That's such a big question.
I'm sorry, I didn't know if there was something specific, but...
I think that from my point of view, which is as a trial lawyer, as a plaintiff's lawyer, which is kind of like the eighth circle of hell, that the problem with the systems is that they are no longer predictable, and that they do not necessarily map to how people and how the science is acting.
Right.
So a good example is patenting DNA. That is
impossible by the Patent Act.
Yeah, I mean the patent is for discovering something new, not for saying, "Oh look, I see that now all of a sudden.
And the distinction traditionally, and again, this is where I was starting to go to with my comment that I'm not the scientist, but I know how patent law is supposed to work in at least a broad brush view, because I teach, I'm supposed to know something about it. But the distinction is that discoveries are not patentable, inventions are. If I just discovered gravity, I don't get to patent it. It'd be fun to exclude you all from using it. But I don't get to patent something.
Or creating it.
Yeah. I don't get to patent something that I discover. And discover, of course, means, oh, look, I found this. It was here all along. Now I understand it, or now I noticed it. I invented something. That's what actual scientists are supposed to be doing. They create something different that wasn't already there. That's patentable. Yet, that's not how the patent laws are being applied right now. And I have students who will bring up, well, what about this patent? And I just have to stand there and go, you got me. Because by everything I know about how patent law is supposed to work, which again is the academic level of how the laws are written, not the actual what we do in the patent office, and by we, I mean they, it doesn't make sense. It is completely foobar from any rational standpoint. The Copyright Act looks beautiful compared to that.
But is it really completely foobar? There's a direction there. In many cases, there's something called a mycoplasma. It's something that in the early 1970s, before U.S. was called on to say, "Hey, let's not do this biological warfare," it could have been weaponized. It probably was, and it was given a patent. And you know, the person didn't create it. They just kind of attributed their search into it and managed to get a patent.
I think I'm going to use an analogy and hopefully answer your question that way. When your accelerator sticks, you're foobarred. You may not crash for a few minutes, but you're already there. And that's where we are, is that there are some cases on the margins, and the one you talked about may be it, where the system will still work the way it arguably should. But right now, we're heading towards a cliff and the accelerator's stuck. You know, it's just, when do we go over?
Business method patents alone are just insane. I think that they finally disallowed the patent that involved filing by alphabetical order. But no joke, that one was going through, and I think it was issued and then later failed at a trial. But the business method patents especially are just a hugely stupid area of, you can't do that. I kid you not, I don't have the number memorized. Google sideways swing patent. You will come up with a USPTO document written by actually a patent lawyer whose kid came up with the idea, but the patent lawyer went through the patent process to, instead of sitting on a swing forward and back, you sit sideways. All of us did this at some point. You sit sideways and smash the kid next to you, get in trouble and have to go to timeout. One of these kids, his father, the patent lawyer, patented sitting the opposite way on the swing and swinging back and forth like that. It's patented.
Successfully.
It is in the USPTO database.
How much does it cost to contest a patent?
Lots.
Versus how much does it cost to create a patent?
Lots.
I think less lots, but still lots.
But lots. And one of the things about patents that makes it less accessible is you can't do squat with patents without a lawyer, and not just a lawyer, but a patent lawyer.
Yeah, the patent bar is a special subset of the bar. You have to take the patent bar test on top of the normal bar test.
It's the only area of law in which that's true.
And admiralty.
There's not an actual test for it, though.
I think there is.
Is there?
I don't know. Maybe not.
Which is a good reason why you should have been at the earlier session we had today, all about trademarks, patents, and all that stuff. We had a whole session on that, and they covered all of that. So
go back in time. Patent it.
Patent the time travel.
Come to all the EFF tracks. That's the moral of that story.
China's becoming a manufacturing powerhouse. How do you see this treaty dealing with China and copyright infringement, manufacturing, patent infringement?
China's not party to it just yet.
I know.
I mean, China's a sovereign nation. Short of actually invading them, we can't make them do anything.
Sure.
And invading's a bad idea. Never getting a land war in Asia.
Right. We know that. Don't fight on two fronts. Don't get in a land war in Asia.
All that being said, the United States' history is, before we hit the Industrial Revolution, we didn't give a flip about anybody else's patents or copyrights. And then as we suddenly started having our own works to protect, then reciprocity, where Britain could treat us the way we were treating Britain, that's a bad thing. So as China develops and bootstraps themselves up into a powerhouse, they will suddenly find out that the shoe is on the other foot.
And suddenly they'll want to join the club too. But it's not coincidental that they're not a party to the negotiations for AFTA right now. Again, it's not a coincidence that most of the developing nations are not party to it. Right now, the people negotiating this amongst themselves are the countries in general who have rights that they want to protect.
And Morocco.
And Morocco, just because it's kind of cool.
Casablanca. Okay. We are 10 minutes over, so do we need to wrap up, or should we keep going a few more minutes if there's questions?
Asking.
Oh, there you are.
One last question.
One last okay. question. Who's lucky?
Of course, or they're unlucky. None at that point.
Anything.
Make us feel loved.
As long as it's not about insurance.
Well, I mean, the U.S. is definitely not alone in having a crazy, messed up patent system. I mean, a friend of mine up in Canada used to work for the Canadian Patent Office, and it's just as completely insane. And like, he's only working on it from an engineering point of view, but. Mm-hmm. It's still fairly, fairly.
Yeah, it's apparent. Broken.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's internationally broken as well.
Like on these 19th century models that are.
Yeah, and I can go through, and if any of you have trouble sleeping, call me, and I will walk you through how I think we can fix the Copyright Act. There are lots of ideas, both academic and actual practical, that we can do to craft some solutions for the Copyright Act or to trash it and start over. Patents? Oh, good God, I have no idea. I can look at it and say, that's messed up. But I've got nothing productive to say in terms of how to fix it.
Because fixing the patent system at this point involves nullifying a bunch of patents, and will be screaming when it happens.
Because you're taking away someone's property in effect, and we're not supposed to do that. But you can. You can. I mean, takings clauses. You know, you're allowed to take. It's done all the time.
As far as the
The court case that Lawrence Lessig argued over the Supreme Court, where they said that the extension was valid.
Oh, yeah, Eldred v. Ashcroft.
Yes. And they said the extension was valid because
copyright, not patent.
Correct. But I imagine that the same thing would happen. Their logic was they could do an extension because the people who created the work could have realized that the times could have been changed later retroactively.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, that would make it seem as if a copyright treaty could, or a law could, change things backwards, and it would make me think that patent could change backwards as well.
There's a big distinction, especially in the law, between extending people's rights and contracting them. So if your copyright issued and the rule was, you know, life plus set with 50 and it was extended to life plus 70, that's okay because your rights just got farther. But it would be difficult to convince the Supreme Court justices that they could contract it shorter.
And the problem with patent is that patent is for a limited term, but in these cases, because it's a theoretical shift, then suddenly things are not patentable anymore, and the existing patents that shouldn't exist, you know, limiting their term is kind of worst of all worlds. So
and
it's not probably not going
to
happen.
Limiting isn't even as bad as taking them away completely, which needs to happen. So these people have, and you have nothing else, they can make a not completely spurious argument of, I went through the patent process. That cost me $25,000 because at the time the law was that could be patented. And lo and behold, here was my patent. I have developed my business based on the existence of this patent which issued. And it's not that I lost in a lawsuit later because my patent was held invalid. You, government, on whom I relied, changed the rules and took away the entire structure of my survival. That's not a completely stupid argument, even if the patent underlying it is.
To be, I don't know if this is a devil's advocate or the opposite, but the other argument I think that Lessig argued is that the public expected to have the rights, so it was effectively a taking from the public. So
it's easier to take from the public than from an individual.
Oh, yeah, true, yeah.
Lessig lost that argument, keep in mind. He made a lot of very elegant arguments, none of which were accepted.
So how could the patent system be replaced without affecting substantive due process to current patent holders?
probably, I think we're saying you can't.
The asteroid hits and it just ends everything.
I mean, when fire, maybe, but...
When I become empress, we will be able to fix this because many of those quaint things like due process will become discretionary. And then we will fix the patent office.
So we'll have undue process? That's excellent.
I support your good preference based only on that.
Yeah, I'll vote for you for empress.
And it'll be a limited term, by the way. I think it'll take me 10, 15 at the outside to get things straightened out, and then I'm retiring because I'm much too lazy to go for a lifelong power grab. And my kid is smart, but I wouldn't want to saddle him with governance. So 15 years, I'll get everything straightened out. 10 if I can do it. I'm getting a hell of a golden parachute. There'll be some ponies involved, and I'm out.
And then we're on our own.
And I'll reinstate the democratic government because it's not a bad process. You can be in the cabinet. My cabinet members get paid really well.
Okay, we'll take that one.
And we work 4 days a week.
Four?
Yeah.
Four.
Three?
Well, four for the first couple years. There's a lot to do.
Fine.
You can have a jet to go where you want for the weekend.
Okay. And an island.
Sure. If you stay through the end, you get an island. It's part of the severance package. Okay. If you go out early, you know, you just get some land in Florida.
I want Manhattan for $24 and bees.
With ponies.
Do I have to pay you $24 to take it?
I'll pay you $24.
Oh, okay. Wait, and the beads. I want the
in
beads.
No, in beads.
Oh, in beads. Oh, that's even better.
Yeah. Mardi Gras beads. Okay.
And ribbons. Okay. So we will, and when I'm empress, I will solve the patent office and a lot of these other things because I won't have to fuss with those silly due process rules. I'll just fix it. Because I said so, will be on all the posters.
But in the meantime, it is a snake.
Until
pit.
Then, yeah, good luck.
I think we're done.
Okay, thank you.